So I'm with my friend Stephen Wilson, who's a photographer from Northern Ireland, who's just finished a project, and we're going to talk a little bit about that project, talk a little bit about the themes, and I'm very interested in connecting some of what you're doing visually with some of the stuff that I'm interested in. In fact, I wrote an essay in the book, so I have a particular interest in this. And I want to talk to you about this, as a practice, I have a feeling that this book could be what I would want to call a decentering practice. But we'll get into that in a second. To start with, who are you? What do you do?
Hi, thank you very much for being here and also for your essay in the book. It's great, very uplifting. I'm Stephen, I'm a photographer, and I've been a photographer now since I was 17, so 35 years, more, 40 years nearly. I have worked as a photographer and photojournalist in London, and then came back to Belfast, travelled a little bit around the world, seen a few places for newspapers and magazines, and then came back to Belfast and worked here for a few years, and now I teach photography and do my own projects.
And before we get to this, even, do you have certain themes in your work, of certain kind of things crystallised, or do you have a wide variety of interests?
Well, when I used to work professionally as a photojournalist, you were commissioned to do work, or you do work and then try to sell it. So that depends on what's happening and what you think you can sell. But since I started doing more of my own projects, which are not commercial projects, this was possibly the first one, looking at people's identity, especially in Northern Ireland, returning to Northern Ireland after the Good Friday Agreement and setting up a home here. Things were changing, we were changing, and I kind of thought, let's look at this and see how I can represent this, as opposed to just covering events which happen in the news. Let's see what's behind the scenes, and let's get involved with people. So I've worked a lot with community groups and people who are involved in reconciliation, done workshops and used photography as a tool. Photography is a great tool because people talk a lot about, oh yeah, let's do a little art project here, what can we do? And lots of people can't draw, so it's quite a high level of entry into drawing or making art. Whereas photography is a very low level of entry because everyone can take a photograph. Mm. So I do workshops with people quite a lot of the time where we map our areas or show things that are important to us or photograph the streets and our houses and then bring groups together and compare and contrast and open up conversations about my identity and your identity and my location and your location. And I find that fascinating.
By the way, I saw a quote just this morning on Instagram. You know, you get these quotes, and it was about painting, but I thought it was very clever. But I actually think it might be even more appropriate for photography, so see what you think. It said, painting is easy when you don't know how to do it, and difficult when you do. And I kind of think that's potentially even more so with photography. It's super easy when you don't know what you're doing. Completely. I can take photos as much as I want, but when you get into being a photographer, that's when it gets difficult.
It is. And like all these things, if you playing around is a great thing, but whenever you start to take something seriously, then the play sort of leaves it, and then it becomes more difficult. So you've always got to kind of re-engage with that. Picasso said that all children can paint, they just slowly forget how to do it as they get older. And our job as artists is to remember how to paint.
Very good.
So it's that playful idea in art. Picasso said a lot of things. Some of them,
he famously, what did he say? He said, I want to live like a poor man, but with lots of money. Like something like that was brilliant. I want to live like a vagabond with nothing, but with a lot of money.
I teach, and lots of people ask, and students often ask, and are struggling with what things mean. And I think he's a great statement. Art is a lie that tells the truth. Mm. So this is not true, but there is truth in it. And that's a conversation which is worth having, but don't take this as fact. It's not the truth.
Yeah. Funny thing is, Hegel kind of took an opposite position about children, because sometimes we do romanticize children. They see things and they can experience things and they have this, and then we lose it. But Hegel's view was actually, well, kids can kind of take a lot in, but actually through education and through training and through these skills, what you learn is to abstract. And abstract to a certain point, that in a visual or in a concept, you can crystallize something incredibly profound. So he was more skeptical of the idea that we, you know, return to being children, saying, well, that's great, that childlike creativity.
Yeah.
But actually what comes from because that can be a bit of an excuse as to not do the hard damn work. You have to go into the hell of this difficult work of philosophy or art in order to crystallize in a simple way as some sort of universal concept.
It is, we do idealize that childish joy. But the key thing, I think, is over time in your practice, whatever that practice is, you learn skills, and those skills are hard by their very nature, or else they wouldn't be a skill. So keeping, as you learn those skills and become better at doing something and more accomplished, but keeping that enthusiasm is very hard, because most people become, you know, obsessed with the skill or just making money and forgetting about why they're doing something. Yes. So that is, there's an, obviously it's a kind of a duality there, which is, you can see the appeal of it, definitely the craft is something which we can't forget. There's a lot of craft involved.
Yeah, and like a child can say something very profound sounding, but and then somebody who's 80 years old can say the same thing, and you go, wow, it's very, very profound. But generally the child is just saying things, whereas the 80-year-old who is the Buddhist monk who's dedicated, whenever they say something like hold lightly or whatever, it comes from this, it reconnects with that moment, but with such a depth and intensity.
That's interesting, reconnecting. But that's the thing, children are always saying things, but often we read quotes on Instagram where people say, oh, you never guessed, my 4-year-old said this today. By the very nature of the fact that you're saying it means it's an exception, and also you've noticed that then most of what they say is rubbish, but this one thing sounds a little bit like a philosopher.
Exactly, and also we are able to read into it what maybe the kid didn't.
So again, my contention with photography, most of photography is editing. So what as a parent you're doing there is you're editing all the things that the child has said, and you edit out the one, and you present that one and saying this is important.
And that's kind of exactly what Hegel was getting at, actually, is that in a way, whenever it's talking about honing down stuff into a kind of a universal, it's, editing is probably the photographic version of that, is that the ability to see all the sea of stuff and to find something, and we'll get to this book in a way, because I think it captures something universal. It's something, you know.
So it's all these things, but essentially you are finding, like you say, finding something and thinking, I want to photograph that, and then people say, why did you photograph that? There's a quotation by a photographer called Jerry Ulsman, and said, if you look at something long enough, it becomes interesting. So the reason it's not interesting is because you haven't looked long enough, is the implication there. And I think Grayson Perry is a fantastic artist. Did a lecture where he said what artists essentially do is point at things and say, that's art. I know what art is, and that's art, so now you need to look at it and interpret it as art. They may point at a painting, they may point at a telephone box, it doesn't really matter, but their expertise and their knowledge now proclaiming this is art.
Yes.
So it's like the artist Banksy. Whenever he did a mural, somebody took the mural, cut it off the wall, literally removed it and put it into a gallery, tried to sell it, and he said, that's no longer a Banksy.
Yeah.
So I have unowned this. I said it was art, now you've done this, I'm saying it's not art anymore. So with that, I think that's what photography is. Often we're drawing people's attention to something, framing something and saying, I think this is interesting.
Yes. I mean, even if you say the same word again and again and again, eventually it becomes foreign and it becomes like an object. And, you know, you could do it with the word cow or something, you say cow, and until you kind of almost detach it from the signifying chain and it becomes this object. So sometimes I think the artist is doing that. There's these familiar images that become strange through being photographed.
Yeah, I think the job of an artist is a strange job, and it's a confusing job and misunderstood in many ways. And also people objectify something and make it something that it's not. But that is definitely one of the jobs of an artist, is to spend time looking and then come back and saying, like you go to the Galapagos Islands and study penguins or butterflies, whatever else, you come back and say, I spent 18 months and I found this, it's interesting. And everybody else just needs to spend 5 minutes looking at the interesting highlights.
Yeah.
That's your job. It's a research job.
Yeah. And one of your central insights, central kind of like interests, and by the way, I did give him a coffee. He just drank it quickly. So in case everybody's watching this, he's drinking a coffee and never gave his guest a coffee. He did have
very
a coffee.
Good coffee as well, I must say.
It's really good coffee. I do good coffee. Identity, political, religious identities, how people connect and have a social bond, that's something that seems to be of interest to you then.
It is of interest, and I think like all situations, when you leave an area and live somewhere else, it helps you. You have to sort of level up, as it were, because you know nothing's familiar. But then you also start to notice things about other people. You know, the tea tastes different here, and oh, people pronounce that word differently here, or they drive on the other side of the road. These are interesting things. But also you notice about yourself and think, I wonder why I did that. I wonder why. I start asking questions about myself and what my identity is. And I think identity, these are sort of constructs which are essentially conditioning, and they're conveniences, they're shorthands, or the way we some of them become are from society around us, and some of them are because of geography, some of them are personal. I think looking at that meant, and being Irish, identity is a big thing, you know. Yeah. Everywhere you go in the world, you know, being Irish is kind of like the golden ticket, isn't it?
Yeah. People like the Irish.
It's the one identity where no one's going to fall out with you apart from other Irish people.
That's true. Yeah. Well, here, I want to start talking about this. Before we talk about it, I just want to say, and I'll say this at the end as well, this book is currently, it's finished, it's been designed, and you've got a Kickstarter that is designed to kind of raise the initial funds to get the print run done. And we'll have details about how you can kind of see that Kickstarter, wherever beneath this video or something like that.
Just point at the corner of the screen.
Yes, right there. So, yeah.
Just covering my face.
That's right, exactly, right there. So, yeah, tell us then about a little bit about this project, what it's called, what you were exploring.
So, like I say, it's kind of a discovery. I think when photography is what I do to help. When I don't understand something, I photograph it. I take pictures to try to spend time with the problem and enjoy investigating or interrogating the problem. So I've done a lot of work, like I said, with community groups and learned a lot about people who work on both sides of the Northern Ireland problem and trying to bring people together. And I've learned a lot from how working with people, how our similarities and differences. And I decided to... photographers need a thing. In creative world, if you're a sculptor, you can sculpt something that comes into your mind, or you can paint an emotion. Photographers look at something, and you need a thing to photograph. So quite often what we're doing is we're photographing something that we think represents possibly something else, or might be interpreted differently. So it's a point that people can have as a discussion. So I did the usual stuff around buildings, stuff around places, stuff around people. Most of my work is photographing people. And I sort of thought it would be nice to look at the Protestant community, but not the actual people, but look at the community that makes people. That's a sort of like a step back. It's not looking at the object, it's looking at the shadow that the object casts. Mm. And we are products of our environment, but also we shape our environment. I think that's kind of interesting, and then there becomes a little bit of a detective thing where people look at something and they're kind of working out, oh, who would live in a house like this, like that, through the keyhole program.
The keyhole, yeah, I remember that program, which for anybody who doesn't know, they would show you around a house, and it was like some celebrity, yeah, usually kind of a small celebrity, and you had to guess, oh, they maybe gave you four options, and you had to guess who owned the house.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is great, because that we all do that kind of thing, and when we see somebody's home, we go, oh, I didn't think you would read those kind of books, or, yeah, oh, goodness me, they live in a real mess of a house, or whatever. So we're trying to get a little bit behind the surface. So I like that idea, and also there is a... It's a story I tell people about. I working in Northern Ireland, I have had the pleasure of working with some really good journalists who come from all over the world, from New York Times, Washington Post, Paris Match, the Sunday Times in London, coming to Northern Ireland to cover the situation. There's always something happening. Let's do both sides of the argument. And my experience is, after a week of travelling around with people taking photographs, they would say, so we've been to a lot of nationalist communities where I ask these nationalists, what is it you want? And they say, we want Ireland as a nation and we want the Brits out. Okay, that's a kind of an easy answer. I talk to Protestants about what is it you want, and they say, we're not Irish. Yeah. And you go, okay, you're not Irish, but what do you want? And they say, we're not British. And they say, okay, you're not British and you're not Irish, but what do you want? Yeah. And they say, why are you asking so many questions? Yeah. And the reporter feels a bit intimidated. They get a little bit threatened. And I thought, that's kind of it. It's a people who are defined a little bit by what they're not. So that's fine. We all do that. You know, we leave home.
I actually like that. I mean, I'm very pro that because I'm against identity politics. So we can get more into it. But yeah, but I'm interested in a group of people who don't want to be identified positively with something is very interesting to me. But anyway, keep going.
I'm sure we'll return to that.
We'll return to that.
I had done some workshops with a management consultancy group helping leaders, and they talked about how there is a push and a pull, a motivation to do something. You can be away from something, but somebody grows up in poverty and thinks, this is not a life for me. I'm not going to not be like my parents. I'm going to make money. So they become a successful business person. So that's their push away. And then, of course, they become a successful business person and they think, oh, this money's useless. I'm still very unhappy. I'm on my third wife. I've started three businesses, sold three businesses. It's really boring because they pushed away from something and escaped it, but they didn't know what they were going towards. Mm. So these consultants talked about how you should have a pull towards a goal. So make sure you visualize a goal that you're going to head towards and review your goal and keep heading for something so you can be positive, not negative. And I thought that's kind of what this culture has produced. You've got a group of people, well, in Northern Ireland, the Protestant people based around a faith, essentially, and that faith has meant them splitting from the Catholic Church in Geneva, then moving through Germany and the Calvinists, then moving to Scotland, and then moving from Scotland to Ireland, and then, of course, from here they moved to America. They're always good at leaving groups that they don't agree with, and leaving, because this is not perfect, and we can do it better, so we'll start again. And quite often they move. Now, that's a great concept, and that's also a good way to refine an idea, and it's, nobody should be forced to do something they don't want to do. But in that, there's a problem I felt of not actually knowing what success looks like. Mm. They sort of know what they don't like, and I think there's a struggle internally. So then people say, why are you unhappy? Well, I'm going to blame them for my unhappiness, as opposed to I haven't achieved a goal. So I thought it'd be nice to photograph that, and that kind of kicked a long story here, but that I thought there's something intrinsic about this culture which comes from a faith, and the faith is something which is kind of in many ways defined as not something. I know the faith is quite clear, and people who have a strong belief will tell you what their faith means, but there's a very strong push away and a very difficult looking towards. And as I unwrap that, we'll talk, I'm sure, more about how that is very visual and it's very difficult to exist in a void.
Yeah, because it's funny. So I love this, right? And one of the reasons why I loved this book, and we haven't even, it's funny, we're talking very abstractly.
Yes.
So what is it? Actually, in fact, before I jump in with theory, then concretely, what's it called and what are the photographs of? Because I don't think we've said that yet.
No, we're on about art and not talking about the book.
Which is what these people will want, right? If there are people who follow my work, they like the theory, but still, contextualise it a tiny bit.
Yeah, so the book is called Liminal, because I was photographing churches, and we'll see some of these photographs, I'm sure Peter put them up on the screen, and I photographed I thought, to understand the people you have to understand the faith, and the faith, I can't photograph a faith, so I'll photograph what these people hold important. And that, like I say, these people, it's my culture. I come from a very religious Protestant culture, and the faith is the important thing. So what's happening on TV, what's happening in government and politics, what's happening in the village, not so important. What's happening in church, crucial. Okay, and your part in what's happening in church and your role in this operation is extremely important, and a lot of your identity comes from that. And I thought, let's look at the buildings that this happens in, maybe a bit more impartially, because I haven't been in them for years since I moved away. So I thought, looking at them, come back and realised, yes, there's a stoicism, there's this idea of lack, there's this idea of we can't have a distraction. Catholic Church is very ornate with lots of icons, lots of paintings and drawings which illustrate stories. You can follow them. So people who can't read and understand the written word, can look at an image and tell a story. Protestant churches don't have that because that would be distracting. So I came up with this word. I thought liminal, which is a build and a space which is a transition. So a train station is a liminal building which you move through on a journey. A train station is not a destination. And I thought churches are liminal spaces because you move through them to meet God. So I'm going to photograph this space that's not meant to be looked at. It's here to be passed through, because you don't go to a train station and stand around looking at a train station. You rush through it to get on your train to get to meet your friends.
Yes.
So let's stand back and think, well, if we're going to have a building to keep us warm and dry, but the building's not going to distract from its main purpose, what, as a design concept, that's fantastic, but it's not engaged with in that way. It's more engaged with in a, oh, let me see, it's cheap and it's functional and it's warm and dry. Beyond that, we don't really need anything more. And I thought, let's look at that, because that kind of sums up my experience of a personality type, where hard-working people of faith, you know, they don't really want you to say, those are nice shoes, or I really like your hat. They want you to say, you're a good person, or why weren't you at church on Sunday, or what did you think of that sermon, or they want to discuss the important things and the peripheral things. So we live in a very commercial world, and peripheral things. Richard Avedon is a great photographer, and he talked about, as a photographer, people talk about, oh, I want to scrape below the surface and see the real person. But the surface is all we have. Yeah. We photograph the surface. We can't see what's inside. There is nothing else. So we have to look at the surface and use that as our toy box.
Yeah. Because this is then gets to the heart of my interest with this book, is I am very interested in this idea of space, of desert, of gap, and of no identity. And what you've kind of caught in these images, which as you say, like in Catholic churches, you have so much iconography. It's like you look everywhere and there's images and there's stories. And you know, one of the reasons for that is almost to overwhelm the senses, to bring you to a sense of considering the transcendent. But these spaces that you have photographed are spaces that are empty. They're quiet. They're desolate. And there's something, so here's the thing, and I'm interested because I don't know whether you went into this almost kind of like this is, at first, this is maybe a not a great thing or something, but I think your book is a celebration of a type of negation, a type of nothingness. And you know, for me, in a society of pure positivity where it's all about doing and having and being and filling your life with all sorts of things and seizing the day and all of that, having a desert in the oasis, having a space which is not about some getting some object, whether it's God or whether it's drugs or a person or whatever, but being in a space of a liminal space and directly enjoying that liminality, if that's a word, is something I think we're profoundly missing. This, by the way, is why I see your book as potentially, which looks like a hymn book. I want to talk about that in a second. It's designed almost like a hymn book, but with this void in the middle. The reason why I like to call it a decentering practice is in the midst of all of the intensity of life, opening this book and seeing these images that are so quiet and so spacious and so liminal, that for me is a way for people to take a breath from something like Instagram. You know, so there's something about no identity, there's something about spatiality, there's something about nothing that, I mean, you're kind of in one sense photographing nothing.
Yeah, that in one way, when I started digging around and chatting to people who understand theology more, and people in the church and people who have read more theology, and yourself and others, I kept coming back where people talked about, yeah, so it's this idea of nothing. So nothing can distract from the worship. Nothing can distract from your commune with God. So these icons or gilded walls become a distraction. And we know it. You know, we all go to cathedrals when we visit a beautiful Italian city. We look at a cathedral because it's beautiful, and you do feel lifted onto a higher plane. But you kind of get distracted by the object, and you become to essentially worship the object. So there is an element of that, and I thought that is what I really, if nothing can represent us as a community, I want to photograph nothing.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought, well, maybe people saying, I'm not British, I'm not Irish, why are you asking so many questions? I don't like where this is going. They're essentially saying, you can't put me in a box. Mm-hmm. Don't try and put me in a box, just leave me alone.
Yeah.
Which is a fair, like, you don't have to have a flag, you don't have to have a viewpoint, I can just be me.
Yeah.
We are human beings. Being is good.
Yeah.
We don't have to do or have a name. And I kind of thought, well, actually, that comes across wrong, but actually as a concept, that's quite a good concept. And
yes, I love the way you said it, because whenever I'm defending it, it's like the way it's done here is often not great, but in it there's something good. And that's why I think what you've caught is, like, yes, on the surface, and that's why Protestantism and loyalism is to a large extent a laughing stock in terms of, for a lot of people, especially the educated people, the elites laugh at loyalists, yeah. and they're a joke. But actually, I think there's something profoundly beautiful and powerful and universal in a loyalist experience. And I think that you're capturing that, and that's what I want to get to, because it's so easy to reject and see them as a laughing stock. But there's something about protest, Protestantism, protest. There's something about I am not, the not, the nothing, the negation, that... I would say is universal, that we're not unified. So one of the critiques that people who are liberals who associate with the left, one of the things they say is that those who are liberals on the right, they affirm positive universals like merit, truth, justice, facts. So people on the right tend to go, we want to build a community based on universal principles that are the same for everybody, right? Just say truth, merit, facts, whatever. So facts don't care about your feelings, meritocracy. These are talking points on the right. And then people who are who embrace identity politics, they say, well, all of these supposed universals actually benefit some people more than others. So you say, well, you know, meritocracy, we're all in a meritocracy, it's blind, but the judicial system does favor some groups over other groups. And so they embrace not positive universals, they embrace particular positions. So the position is not equality. Equality is the right. Equity is the liberal left. And equity means you give different groups different things depending on what they need, because there is no universal that just works. So all you have are different communities that intersect with each other and have to learn to live with each other. But the critique of critique, I think the Marxist critique, whatever, is that no, there is a universal, it's not a positive universal. The universal is we all share nothing in common. That at the very core, as creatures of language and creatures of desire, we are all riven with a type of lack that is even in language. So we speak because we can't really ever say exactly what we want to say, right? So we always, that's why we want to take more photos, write more books, because there's something we're always missing. Even when we're brilliant communicators, in fact, often brilliant communicators are people who are obsessed with saying the thing, but they just can't, so they have to, you know, new ways. And so language and desire and psychoanalysis are intertwined, because both signal a certain lack that is what it is to be human. So whenever I think of kind of the loyalist community and the fundamentalist evangelical Protestant community and all of the, you know, not so good things, there's something bubbling in there of the not, of a negation. And it's there, but it's hard to see. This is why as photographer, you almost have to take a snapshot. It's like you can't see it. But it's there, and you've taken a snapshot of that negative.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, because we live in a, we are, you know, spiritual beings in a physical body, and there's a struggle. And I think it's interesting where this identity came from, and it manifested, obviously, as a religious group, a faith-based group, putting faith first, but at the same time, concepts philosophy was evolving and society was evolving and art was evolving. And out of these same revolutions in thinking, certain things happened. And we have now a modernist movement where it didn't happen at the time. This argument formed Protestantism because obviously then to make something more beautiful, you just rolled it in more glitter, essentially. Therefore, it's more beautiful. Yeah. And therefore, you get these gilded cathedrals, which are just the more glitter, the better.
Yeah.
A way of thinking was, well, after a little while, there's too much, so maybe less is more. Mm. Obviously, the statement less is more. And in the art world, we have now people who spend an awful lot of time designing minimalist buildings and objects and kinds of art where they're trying to work out how little can I show and still get an involvement? How can this object be functional and nothing more than pure function? That's a design ethos, yeah, which we have now developed, which has come from the same place.
Yes.
But interestingly, often when something happens, we become attached to the way it happened at that time. Mm-hmm. And then as society moves on, the affiliation becomes with the way things happened, not with the idea that made it happen. So, as you know, people will say, oh, I just like it that way because that's the way we always did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you did it to be different and to be better, and this is not different and better anymore.
Yeah.
But we still like stained glass windows because that's what we grew up with.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing in the very heart of Protestantism. Luther, he based a theology on the death of God, on the crucifixion. Like, he saw the death of Christ as a central thing. And one of the reasons is really fascinating is Luther was very profoundly aware, kind of like before Freud and analysis were there, of projection. Very, very painfully aware of how we create the world in our image. We see it not as a nice and says, we see the world not as it is, but as we are. That it is our unknown face, Jung says, that, you know, we kind of somehow, the way we perceive the world is not objective. Even what we look at, what takes our interest, is saying something about ourselves. And this is a, you know, profound insight that has a lot of interesting things to say, right? But I think Luther, he deeply understood that. And so a real challenge for him was, well, what would it mean to, what does religion mean then? Because religion, all religion is a projection of ourselves. So it's similar to Feuerbach, is that for Luther, any religion will just be, basically tell us about our own ideals, our own values, our own wants, our own thoughts on aesthetics and morality and all of that. So Luther was like, I want to build a theology on the death of God, because we wouldn't have come up with that. The idea of the eternal, everlasting God dying, right, mm-hmm. is such an offense to reason, even logic, because the definition of God is a necessarily existing being, a being that exists of necessity and cannot not exist, right? So that's the definition of God. So to say God does not exist is like saying a four-sided triangle, and we're not going to come up with a four-sided triangle. So in this really interesting way, Luther wanted to find something of pure negation, of pure what our minds could not conceptualize, what we couldn't project. And rather, religion is not a projection, but a projectile, something that smashes something open. And, you know, after that, Hegel came along and he did develop a really interesting philosophy from that. But anyway, coming back then to the very essence of Protestantism, I think, is when you strip it all away, liberalism creates, basically, from the perspective of Feuerbach, whatever, is religion is a projection of ourselves. It shows us who we are, shows us what we believe. All religion does that. So how do you avoid it? You somehow have to develop a religion of pure negativity, a pure no, a pure nothing. And that has influenced both Protestant theology and then philosophy and into whatever. But again, I think your work, that's why I think it's true, is it's actually capturing one of the good things of Protestant theology, which is a pure negation.
Yeah, and I agree, and I can see that.
But you might push against me on this, because I know we probably have different views, so push against if you want. You can be wrong if you want.
I think, yeah, conceptually, that's fantastic. And I love your pointing out, because I heard the word and I thought, that's exactly it. We look at a tree and I say to you, oh, look, from this direction, that tree looks like a head and a person's chin. Mm-hmm. You know, we are anthropocentric.
Yes.
We see the world, we project ourselves into everything. So it's just a tree with some leaves, but you and I both know it looks like a person.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not true. It doesn't look like a person.
Yes.
But it does look like a person. So we enjoy that. And in that, the concept is engaging, and I think the concept holds a lot of water. And I find it interesting that Luther was doing that, because that's where this all came from, and most people who are engaged with this wouldn't engage with that concept.
No.
But in engaging with the concept, we use emotional language, we use our senses, our smell, our touch, and we inhabit a physical body which is sensual.
Mm.
And those senses bring with them good and bad, but that is life.
Yeah.
So we can't have a concept in an abstract way. This concept resides in a person who has a personality and an ego and a history, and will engage in that concept in a way that they want to engage, which may be different to the way that you want to engage. And in that, I think that's the rub of life. You know, we can't eat a concept.
Yes.
And I thought, actually, these buildings are coming from that idea at the time, and they're historical almost, but they're not following through. You know that whenever you talk to somebody and you're going to get your kitchen redesigned, and you're thinking, it's a bit small here, and we've got this much money, and we're going to knock a wall through here, and you bring in an architect, and they go, yeah, what we're going to do is we're going to tear all this down, we're going to rebuild that, and you're going, jeepers, I want it a little bit bigger here. I didn't want you to take all that, because they're going really into the idea, and they're going to pursue the idea at doesn't matter the cost, financially or to you, to go through the process. And you're thinking, could you not just move that out and in 2 weeks' time it'll be nicer? Because you're kind of taking small steps. This is like small steps in some way, and they haven't reinvented everything, or people aren't courageous enough to redesign the whole world that we inhabit. So we'll do a few things here, but we'll just buy a carpet from the local shop, and we'll just get the windows that everybody gets, and we'll just, you know, everything's, that's fine.
Yeah.
But actually it's not fine, because the actual carpet and the actual window are distracting, and they're not very pure, and they're not very well made. So the Shakers and the Quakers took it a stage further, and of course they shut everybody else out, and they said, we're going to design a better broom, because the broom we have is rubbish. And they spent a lot of time and invented the flat broom, or the clothes peg, because less time spent working, more time to pray. So hearts to God, hands to work. Their concept was carried, that's why we studied Shakers in design school.
Oh, yeah.
Because they decided, let's do this as well as we physically can, and let's make this refined and push it further.
As in, they created their design, or their ideal was very highly minimalist spaces. Is that what you're talking about?
So they would take their spaces were designed in a very functional way.
Functionality.
Functionality was the main thing, function over form. But they also would say, well, if we can spend a few days redesigning a broom and it works 20% better than the old broom, that's 20% more time to pray.
Yeah.
Therefore, our time has been well spent. Let's do that.
Yeah.
And that's the ethos of design. It wasn't commercial, but for them the currency was time spent praying, or being efficient with what they had and reusing and making a chair that would last 50 years instead of 20 years.
Okay.
So their chairs were very highly made, very simply made, and structurally very strong, so they would last longer.
Yes.
So we wouldn't have to remake a chair and waste God's provision to us.
Yeah.
And that was taking it, of course, it came much later, and it's, of course, in America, where all these people went after they went as far as they could in Europe, they got to Ireland. The next place to go to is America, and those communities did great things there. I think here we have a little snapshot of a concept that's still being worked out. A concept of, yeah, these things are distracting. How could we be more efficient in our journey through? But it's done, and it's obviously not it's not half-hearted, but it's done in a way which is not fully formed yet. That idea is still working out. And I think in that, like you said, concepts are our goals, and in our struggle to get to the concept, that's where life happens.
Yes, yeah, and totally. And like, just that example, I didn't know that about design. It makes total sense. And I mean, there's so many things that came out of religion, even like the sciences, which is the idea that, well, God would create a universe that, you know, was rule-based, and so the early scientists who were religious then kind of like gave themselves to this. So you kind of, and obviously, you know, Max Weber and the idea of like industrious Protestants, you know, or the generation of like capitalism, and so all these things that come out of religion,
and the Age of Enlightenment,
yeah,
because of education in Scotland,
yeah,
and education was something that was done by essentially, I'm not sure, just the Presbyterians, but the evangelical Protestants in Scotland invested in education for everyone to make it a universality, and because of the education system, essentially the Enlightenment happened in Scotland. That came out of it, and again, there's a schism, there's a falling apart here.
And there's the idea that the excremental remainder is the thing that then becomes important. So if there's a name for it in design, you'll know it if I can remember. But there's so many things, for example, you know, cheese, well, you know, stuff went off and then it became blue cheese. And then, you know, some wine, you know, gets, you know, goes off and it's champagne. And there's like, there's lots of things, so many things in our world that are, that were externalities, that were the excremental remainder that then become the really interesting thing. What you're photographing is, of course, consciously the excremental remainder of these fundamentalist gospel halls, right? They're not, but actually this excremental remainder that you've captured is, I think, the goal. This is the blue cheese, the cheese that went off that you can now sell for double. Organic food, those are apples that look a bit shit. We can, you know, put 20p more onto them and sell them as organic, right? This is, you know, the people who are creating these spaces aren't necessarily saying that we need a space of negativity, a space of negation, a space where we're freed from the pursuits of life, free from the pursuit of what we desire, free from some self-help goal, right? They're in there just creating this space, but you kind of go like, oh, that space that you're creating that really doesn't do anything is potentially a photographing of the most interesting bit, grace. The grace of, like, you just be in this silence, in this space. And you don't want to live in these. You wouldn't want to live in them. But maybe we need to go here for an hour a week.
Yeah.
Not to hear the gospel, but to sit in a space outside of this frenetic pursuit of happiness, wholeness, completeness, positivity. Like, there's this image of the chair just, like, you know, sitting there alone, it just strikes me as a space of being outside of the world of and all its frenetic demands to enjoy. In analysis, they go like, the superego now isn't the voice that tells you be nicer to your mum, maybe call a friend who's sick. The superego injunction for most of us is, you're not having enough sex. You're not having enough fun. Oh, there's loads of things happening out there, and you're so it's a superegoic injunction to enjoy life more that causes anxiety. Mm-hmm. It causes what they call fear of missing out, but it causes anxiety and depression. This is the kind of space for you to learn to enjoy missing out.
Yeah, that's an interesting, because you mentioned earlier about that Instagram or TikTok aesthetic where more is always better and more choice. You know, yes. It's hard to argue against more choice. It's hard to say, you know, less is more. But this is a kind of an antidote. And I think it's interesting because always, you know, to take photography, because it's the language that I know. I grew up in a dark room developing film and shooting film. And that was the world I lived in. Digital came along. Everyone moved over and said, isn't this great? 20 years later, everyone's going, film's quite good, I think I'd like to try film, something about it. And people like me go, oh, we ripped out our darkrooms years ago, all that stuff's in a skip because nobody wanted it. And now you can't find a darkroom, you can't buy darkroom chemicals, you can't buy enlargers because they're so rare. So just at the point where something becomes irrelevant and forgotten about, another generation come along going, well, there's some good stuff in that. Why are we not doing that? Because it's not perfect, but I can see now that somebody's invented it, let's not uninvent it. And I think sometimes I look at these pictures and this work and go, in a world where we've moved on a little bit more and things are very instant and everyone's starting to realise too much information is no information, maybe we need to step back.
It also causes, modern symptoms of burnout, fatigue, depression, melancholy, even things like ADHD and autism, which are very much on the rise. There's some senses in which there are very interesting thinkers who connect those with a world of saturated material, saturated information. And so this experience, this is why I call this a decentering practice, is that, and one of the things I love most about this is actually the cover of the book, which in the essay that I put in the book, I talk about a very small sect. They're so hard to find any information on. We talk about this. But I don't know even where I heard of them, but a very small religious sect in Russia who, their icon was literally a hole in the wall. They would carve a hole in the wall and pray to the void, the gap itself. And this idea that, like one of my critiques of atheism, as you may know, was that theism says there is God, a substantive God, and atheism says there is no God. But the more interesting position is God is the name for that which does not exist, that you need a signifier of lack. So by not signifying lack, and you think of it like a zero is a signifying of nothing. That was a number that was invented, but to signify nothingness itself, to make nothingness positive, if nothingness is part of what it is to be a subject, but we deny that and we avoid it and we try to fill that lack and we try to, then potentially that is destructive. But if we can make space for that nothingness, we can signify it, we can like that pray to that gap in the wall, that void in the wall, I think that has a salvatory dimension. I'm going to say one thing, sorry, this might bore you or not, but I've been very interested in Gödel's incompleteness theorems. So in mathematics, fascinating, Gödel shows that something can be true in mathematics but not provable. And to use a metaphor that I think a guy called Rudy, mathematician, it's his metaphor, not mine, but to understand Gödel, he says, imagine you have a computer that can compute anything, everything that's computable. So if you imagine the universe is a total system of cause and effect, material, atoms bouncing against atoms, and if you technically knew everything about where everything was and the speed of everything, the position of everything, you could know everything in the past and know everything in the future, right? If you had an infinite mind, you could know everything. So we imagine a universal truth machine, a computer that you can put in any statement and it will prove it, whether it's true or not. Gödel showed that there's something that that machine cannot compute. And the metaphor is, if I have an algebraic symbol A, and I go A equals, the universal truth machine will never say that this is true, will never prove that this is true, right? That's the statement. The universal truth machine can never prove that this is true. So you put that A is true. So you put it into the universal truth machine. Well, the universal truth machine can't say it's true, because then it would prove it's true and then it would disprove it, because the statement is the universal truth machine can never prove that A is true. So the universal truth machine can't compute this, but it's true. It's a reality that is not computable. So in physics, and Roger Penrose is great, as he says, this is true in mathematics and in the physical universe. The physical universe is completely computable and also generates something that's not computable. And he calls that proto-consciousness. I think it should be called proto-unconsciousness, right? But proto-unconsciousness is a name for saying that it's not just there's something and there's nothing. There's also a nothing that is something. That's another dimension of reality. There is something, there is nothing, and then there is a non-computable, a negation that is something. For me, religion at its best has always been an orientation or a sensitivity to that dimension that I think is vital for human beings to have a sensitivity to that space of negation. And on the front cover of the book, is a hole cut and just this negative space. So for me, this is a, this kind of symbolizes Gödel's incompleteness theorem in a sense, is that a nothing that is something, and that we all need a space to contemplate and to be relate, to tarry with that insistent negativity.
That's interesting, and I love the fact that you're putting some philosophical framework on this. Oh, yeah. Because I'm coming to it with a visual understanding and an idea of engaging with the emotion that these photographs are engaging with. And then I go to a designer and they say, look, I've got this stuff, I want it to look a little bit like this, can we design a book? And they go, well, I've got other limitations to do with print and colour and manufacturing and paper and material. So they bring their expertise in and they try to grab my concept or the same idea, and it's all coming at something from different angles.
Yes.
But essentially we're quite often converging on a point. That's why we're here, in that an example I thought would be nice to make, can we show the cover?
Oh, yeah.
The book with a cover, because there's a photograph, this is a dummy I've made, so it's a very badly made version. There's a photograph of like a wall of hymn books, and the old hymn books have got a linen cover and a red paper edging, and there's about 60 of them in the photograph. And then behind them, you can see some older hymn books piled up, which are more faded. And obviously, they were the ones they used before 20 years ago, but they're still there. And then you think, there's going to be another wall of hymn books in front of that, right? So it's like the physical thing of, after, we don't throw them out. We keep them just in case we have a massive event, which is never going to happen. So the technology, technology is redundant, but also reminiscent, and you don't want to throw it out, but it's still useful, but it's never going to be used. So anyway, hymn books, very tactile, very well designed, because they hold in the hand and they feel good and they last forever. So I thought that would be something good. Then I got the designer, and they came back with a concept and said, okay, your book's called Liminal, about passing through a nothing. Wouldn't it be great if we had a slipcase where you could bring it out and it would unveil the colour, and then you've got nothing. And on the cover of the book, here, we'll do that, available in all good bookshops. The book has got a reset, de-embossed space where it looks like it's a photo book, so there should be, I'll grab a picture here, there should be a picture on the cover, and that would be a normal photo book, where they give you a picture and say, this is what's inside. But he said, why don't we design it to make it look like there should be something there, but it might have fallen off, or maybe it was never there. And that will lead you into the concept of moving through in liminal.
You know, that's like, that's a designer just being lazy, but the excremental remainder of his laziness created something really good. I know the designer, Steve, plus he's just being lazy, and it worked.
So I said, this is great, and I'm going to do a slipcase. And straight away, he said, well, why don't you have the slipcase with a hole in it to show the hole?
Yeah.
And I went, oh, yeah. So technicalities of things. The book's going to cost a fortune to make, because photo books are really expensive, hence the Kickstarter to raise a bit of funds. It's a high-quality book being printed by one of the world's best photo book printers, who are in Istanbul, would you believe?
Yeah.
Fantastic guys. And they have said, oh, yeah, this slipcase, first of all, you can't make it. It's impossible. And I went, okay. And he explained why. There's a few technical issues to do with the way you make these. And he said, if you make it the way you did, it'll always look rubbish, like yours is rubbish.
Yeah.
But we won't make them like that, so it's impossible.
Okay.
So we've got a discussion about it. And then secondly, the case is going to cost double the book.
Yeah. Wow.
And you think, so it's easy to do something which is kind of conventional, but something which is a little bit more simple, but finishes off the idea.
Well, have you found a way of doing it?
Three times as hard. Well, if you've got money, there's a way of doing it. Literally. When he says it's impossible, he meant, yeah, I don't want to do it, you're going to need to pay me a lot.
Like, we can't get people on the moon, so we can't. It is possible to do.
It can be done. But that's, I think, an illustration, a little bit geeky, but to do something quite well, you know, takes you 100 hours, or 1,000 hours in this case. To do it very well doesn't take 1,010 hours. It takes 10,000 hours. Mm. To do that last 5% will take 10 times everything you've done up to this point. And that's like the book, I think slipcase is nice. Mm. Will people pay three times as much for a book with a slipcase, or four times as much? I don't know, but for me, that's the
this. And it might be possible to you. What you do want to have the slipcase?
Oh yes, we're making a limited edition, and he'll make a few of them, and that'll be great. But we won't make as many as the book. But it's just that illustration, I think, why a lot of like the buildings, a functional building with a limited budget and a limited amount of time from a limited amount of people, we can do this.
Yeah.
And you and I come along and go, oh, this is great, this is it. But it's a little bit rubbish the way you did that. And people would be looking at us going, are you joking? We can hardly afford this building. Why would we make it 10 times harder to design a simple chair? Let's just buy a chair around the corner and stick it in. It's okay. Yeah. So these are, everything's a compromise.
Yes.
So these are not design concepts which existed in a university somewhere where they thought, how could we be have a liminal space?
Yeah.
These are people going, we've got this
working
much time.
Working with constraints, absolutely.
And with the concepts that we have, with the understanding we have, what's the best way to do it? And I thought, that's actually interesting, because there are pictures here. I took a picture of some pews, and I thought, this is a farming community, and the pews and stalls look like somewhere you would store animals, because they've worked out the best way to fit the maximum number of people is where this row sits here and looks directly at that person's ear, because he's pointing that way, but we'll get 20 more people in. That's the point. And it will fit, because they're all part of our community, they're all welcome. And I thought, so sometimes the form and the function and the form, they follow.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to recommend you check out this book, check out the Kickstarter. If you've got the funds, recommend you get this book. And genuinely, partly one is if you're interested in photography or interested in art, but two, also as a type of practice, I mean, you know, of taking time and looking at these spaces and looking at these pieces as a way of trying to potentially, you know, I think it's a kind of living critique of the society of pure positivity, and you know, needing a space where you kind of get a desert in the oasis of life, a space where you can step out of that. I think this book is very, very helpful for that as well. So check out the Kickstarter. Definitely recommend you buying it. I'll be buying a copy. I want to get actually some copies for some events that I'm doing. So anything you want to finish off with before we...
Well, no, thank you very much for the opportunity. And it, just as you're saying that, I think I was involved in a long arc, this project, where I went and looked at something, kind of something from my youth, the churches I used to go to, and thought, oh, why do they do this? And why is it like that? I was asking questions, but basically not almost combative way, and taking something apart. And after this conversation, or after spending time, you leave with an appreciation of the physical form, and more an appreciation of the people engaged. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I came asking questions, maybe with a preconceived ideas. My ideas definitely changed, and I think hopefully in the work you can see that it's not a criticism. It's definitely not a criticism. It's definitely an observation, and in that observation, I think there's lots to be learned.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Cheers.